Ja, ich versuche nochmal so ein paar einleitende Worte zu finden. Ich bin unglaublich beeindruckt. Ich habe, glaube ich, ich habe komplett durchgesprochen, eben mich noch mit einer Schülerin ganz lange unterhalten, die auch in der JAV ist, und ich muss mit ihnen reden. Ich bin total sauer und traurig, und weil da jetzt irgendwie Vergasen an der Wand stand. Dann meine ich so, ja, es ging mir auch so. Und ich nehme das mit, aber das ist alles ein bisschen viel und wir müssen das sortieren. Aber es sind auch ganz, ganz viele Schülerinnen und Schüler dabei, die irgendwie rausgegangen sind und das ganz toll fanden und das andere blöd fanden. Und ich glaube, dass mein Vater hat mal gesagt, der ist jetzt schon 76, ich glaube, da darf man ihn zitieren, wenn das Unheil groß ist, steigt auch das Rettende. Also es waren halt auch, Frau Bialas meinte auch gerade, es waren halt 295 tolle Leute da und fünf Vollpfosten. Das wird jetzt alles aufgenommen, ne?
Ich
hab die Idioten. Ja,
also.
Vollpfosten-Idioten. Und,
es gibt so einen Automatismus, dass bestimmte Begriffe gar nicht erst aufgenommen werden.
Genau.
Kennen wir von der NSA nur andersrum.
Okay, und jetzt wollen wir sozusagen nochmal die Zeit. Viele haben mich dann auch gefragt, ja, sollen wir denn jetzt noch fragen? So, all the questions are asked. When it's like this, all the questions are asked, we can leave and everything is okay, we don't have to be here. Wir müssen nicht hier sein und unbedingt was machen. Aber ich glaube, dieser Rahmen, dieses Setting, was Frau Grete hier mit der Mediothek geschaffen hat, gibt vielleicht nochmal Anlass, ein bisschen zur Ruhe zu kommen. Ne? Ich kann es auch zur Ruhe kommen und Sie können nochmal ein bisschen reflektieren und ich kann es nochmal ein bisschen mehr aus der Hand geben an euch. Und ihr könnt euch nochmal ein bisschen mehr Zeit geben, Fragen zu stellen oder zu überlegen, was da ist. I told them to settle down and maybe think about it, to reflect what's happening, and so we can use the time to like ask some more questions or like go in a discussion, because the 200 people is like quite frankly
no, not everyone
easy.
Has a voice,
right?
Most people don't.
And let's try to organize it like this.
Okay.
Vielleicht willst du anfangen, Dirk.
Mit Fragen stellen?
Ja, wenn du eh schon da auf den Stuhl sitzt.
Ich habe gefragt.
Komm schon, also dahingesetzt, was musst du denn das?
My question is, do we really say what we think, or is it very dependent from the context?
Right. So, I mean, I think it does vary in, you know, in different situations, in different social situations. I mean, it depends on how comfortable you are. So, you know, I think in a fantasy land where surveillance didn't exist and people really felt truly what they were saying, there would be no consequence, and you know, or there wouldn't be, you wouldn't be arrested, or your data wouldn't be sold. Then, let me put it this way, and then you know, I think people probably would truly say what they think, but in reality, that's not true. I mean, in my country alone, the UK. We have something called the Snoopers Charter, which I think we discussed on Monday when we met. And it's a draconian law which came in November 2016 by Theresa May, who you probably all know who, I mean, she's the front page of Brexit. And she's always sort of been seen as the face of the police force, like she was the Home Secretary, like the Home Minister, and then she became the Prime Minister, but she's always sort of been the go-to person for the intelligence services for stuff. So she brought in this law, and what it means is overnight with this law, every single person in the country is suddenly under surveillance. Mm-hmm. 70 million people is under surveillance. There is no other law like it in the West. It's basically, it's like China. It's the worst surveillance law, the most invasive, draconian surveillance law, worse than, you know, all America, the whole Five Eyes network of Canada, you know, Australia, New Zealand, America, and the UK. So, in a way, it's quite nice because there's no suspicion anymore that you might be under surveillance or your data might be being surveyed or, you know, or stored and sold. This is confirmation that every single person in the country is under surveillance. 70 million people overnight. What it means is everyone's data is collected and stored for about a year, and it's then sold on to about 125 different government agencies. Everything from the police force to the ambulance service, to the fire service, to the environmental service, to the gambling commission. But that information is readily available, everything you do online. So when this sort of finally sinks in and you realize every move you make with your digital self, you know, it's tracked and stored, potentially sold, and maybe even used against you, you start to say, you know, you stop saying the things that matter to you, that are important to you, that are political, that are provocative, that might create change, that is your activism work. So I think in my country alone, many people probably don't say what they think.
And what do you think, what happened at school? The people say always what they say, what they think, or is the school a real institution where people can learn to say always think what they say what they think?
Yeah, so I think it's I think there are different examples. I mean, in the US and the UK, we have, I spoke a bit about it in the auditorium. I'm not sure what it's like here in Germany and France, but I know in the UK and the US, there is this epidemic, a sort of cracking down of free speech within universities, where groups of students, you know, stand up, create groups within their school to shut down ideas they find offensive, ideas they don't want to hear, ideas they disagree. When I mean shut down, I'm not talking about protesting. Everyone has the right to protest, and I encourage people to protest. If there's a racist speaker talking at your school, or someone from the AFD doing a speech, everyone should be shouting outside that auditorium as loud as they can and protesting. I'm actually talking about the physical shutting down of speech, where people shut off the power, where people run on and they grab the microphone and they shut down the entire speech. I mean, you know, the speaker has to leave because of security reasons. So we have this epidemic where you may have heard of terms like safe space and microaggression and trigger warnings. These are terms that have really only come around in the last 4 or 5 years. Just to give you a bit of history.
Question. Does everybody know what is trigger warning?
We're all sort of aware. I mean, yeah? Like, I know in America and the UK, I mean, you may have heard it on news headlines and on YouTube videos and stuff. But it's like, so we're all clear? Yeah? So,
seems to be.
Okay, fine. So just to give you a bit of sort of a historical background. So in 1995, people born in 1995, they were the first generation of internet users. I am Z Gen. I was born in 1995. And these people grew up with the internet. They grew up surrounded by the internet. This was sort of before Twitter. I mean, they kind of, as they were moving into their teenage years, Twitter was becoming quite big, Facebook was becoming quite big, and they were, they had the sort of opportunity to receive or to see hateful messages, you know, to see hate speech. When those first generation internet users started going to university in 2014, that's when we started hearing about these terms, microaggression, safe spaces, trigger warnings. So with the internet, there's this new generation of millennials, the Z-Gen generation, that are doing everything they can to protect themselves, to prevent themselves from hearing any ideas that they disagree with. And it creates this culture of sort of vindictive protectiveness. And it sort of creates this inability for people to form resilience, for people to understand how to challenge, how to criticize, how to stand up against something they disagree with. I mean, I keep reminding people that this is a skill. It's not something you're born with. It's a skill that you learn only through experience. I can rant sometimes as well, so I've forgotten your question. So what was the main question again?
The question was if our schools are able to build up people who are open-minded, who always say what they really think, in schools, example, in factories, in...
I don't know what the situation is like in Germany, but I know in the UK we do have this big epidemic of basically banning the schools, the unions, the executive boards, in many cases, before they've even spoken, they just ban the speaker because they've had, you know, one of the groups with inside the school have lobbied the executive so hard that they have to ban them. I mean, examples like Nigel Farage, who is, you might know some of you, Nigel Farage, he's like the face of Brexit in the UK. He's a member of the European Parliament, has been for 25 years. He was banned on multiple occasions. We had a leading feminist who once made a comment about, who once made a sort of borderline transphobic comment 15 years ago. She's been banned on multiple times from speaking on campus. Julian Assange, this was even before any of the rape allegations came out. And we have to remember, they are just allegations. He's not been proven guilty. He was banned from Cambridge. He was going to do a big keynote speech in Cambridge, and the executive, you know, called up a week before and said, actually, Julian, we've decided to ban your talk. So some of it's quite political. But most of it is just this new culture that has suddenly appeared with this new generation of internet users. It's sort of a new form of political correctness. I mean, political correctness existed, am I right in saying, in the 80s and the 90s. This is a bit before our time. But it's sort of taken on a new form where you've actually got students going out of their way to ban speakers from actually talking. I mean, there was a professor at Harvard, there was a story in 2015 where law students were trying to ban a professor because the professor was trying to teach them rape law, but there were students in the room that didn't want to be taught rape law because of experience and so on. So they tried, you know, they tried to ban the education of rape law full stop, which I find a bit worrying. Like, we're going to start, you know, we're going to educate a whole generation of lawyers without knowing how to defend rape victims. It's like, okay, fine, that's a bit worrying. So we've got a long way to go, and I really hope this epidemic doesn't reach Germany as well.
Perhaps it's too late.
Perhaps it's too late. I mean, is this a sort of... Because when I started speaking on these topics 3 years ago, when the film was made, this did not exist in Germany. And no one in the audience even heard of the term safe space or microaggression or trigger warnings. I mean, 5 years on, it's almost like we've gone through this era. We had a very heavy era of safe spaces. Now people have kind of come out the other side in the UK and have sort of seen the light a bit and are kind of reversing their thoughts on this. You guys are only just encountering it, maybe.
Some other questions in the audience?
I just want to add something.
To add or ask?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think what Dirk also maybe wanted to address is that many young people, sometimes even myself, also felt like in our school system, not all of the teachers, there were great teachers definitely, but it's just like you were always told what to learn, certain opinions, what to think, and I mean, they kind of want you to have your own opinion and to discuss different topics and use arguments for certain topics and against it, but he was wondering if we were challenged enough in school to learn to really criticize things and make up our own opinions and not just like learn and accept what we are told to do and to study.
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult to comment on every school system around the world.
That's true.
I'm sure they have their own different, their own different things. I mean, I can only really talk about, I suppose, my own experience. I mean, I'm not a philosopher, I'm not an academic. You know, I'm sort of trying to be slightly intellectual, but I'm not you know, I don't really have a background in anything at all. I didn't go to university or film school or anything. I just started making films and asking questions. But, I mean, I think there is like censorship that takes, if that's what you're trying to say, the sort of censorship that takes place at school. I mean, for example, at my school used the same system that the Chinese government uses, the same censorship software that the Chinese government uses in for the whole of China, with taking a few filters out. But for example, at my school, we couldn't access WikiLeaks. And I remember in the last year, there was a politics class, and someone used WikiLeaks in their sort of their dissertation equivalent, and they said they couldn't use WikiLeaks because it wasn't a credible source. But what's fact is that although there are a number of allegations with WikiLeaks, no one's ever denied that the material that WikiLeaks has released ever been not true. It's all been true. We're talking about tens and tens of millions of documents here. So, I'm not sure what else I can comment on that at this stage.
Maybe what schools could do more to make young people critical thinkers, or if you see the responsibility also, or I guess it's definitely also in school.
Yeah, so I mean, it's kind of, I think, touching on what we talked about a bit in the auditorium. I mean, I do think that I am very enthusiastic that schools or education systems do find a way to incorporate this new PSHE lesson, whatever it's called, which is how to be critical or how to be an investigative journalist. I mean, it's sort of what we were talking about in the auditorium. I think to act on Twitter and Facebook, to be a member of the online community, we need this literacy. I mean, it's a sort of given, and it's almost like a sort of social contract that we must accept if we are to participate on the online community. And I think with this training, people will sort of step back and they will maybe think twice before they just sort of click, 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 and write white noise, things that aren't productive. So I think if people could build up this sort of analytical consciousness, this sort of critical consciousness, that they could apply to the whole of life.
Well, maybe I can add something to you. So your question was, how can school like educate critical people? Did I get it right?
Or critical thinking, or enable the students?
Mm-hmm. I hope you can like.
Maybe it's something for the teachers.
Yes, yeah. Of course.
I don't know.
Yeah, I try to answer it. Yeah,
really
try to. And maybe it's like one of those days we do here, one of those projects, who's like, where the pupils itself like. Do the set point what we want to talk about, and just to get in touch with those guys like Harky and this, so like getting inspired and be open minded, and even we talked about all those terms that were on the wall that we don't agree with it, and a girl comes to me and she said she's so tired and stuff, and it's so sad. I mean. And we discussed about it. So we developed an idea how to interact with those kinds of statements. And I think that's a process. So we cannot, a modern teacher in my terms is not standing up in front of the class and tell everybody who has what to learn. In my terms, a modern teacher is somebody who tells you, this is your possibility. I show you how to use those tools. I show you what you can learn. And I like protect you from like writing white noise, because I tell you that's not use to get to use those tools to get involved. And that's not easy in school, I think, but we're getting there.
Yeah.
And maybe this kind of project is the first thing to go, the first step, go further to like give you guys, all the pupils, the opportunity to experience those kinds of terms like free speech. And projects like Friday for Futures, you can see
young people in the age of 13 and 14, as you said at the auditorium, they're getting political, and we have to encourage those people to like investigate these kinds of, to get in touch with this kind of political stuff, and to explain them how to participate in this. Mm. And this is real democracy, and you have to like learn how to use democracy. Mm. And that's what I think about it. But there's a lot of opportunities and a lot of restriction in schools where we have to do certain things. We cannot change the world at one day, but we can try to like going step by step, and you guys can go with us and encourage us teacher to say like, we want to learn this, we want to know that, you know, maybe
yeah,
that's a way.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there are other sort of tools that people can use as well. I mean, you guys were at the event on Monday, so you kind of could speak, hear Jorg speak, but I'm part of the...
So we can go home now.
So I'm part of an organisation called Youth for Planet, and what it is essentially is an organisation that gives people an education of how they can use their smartphones to become critical.
Yeah.
So they do sort of workshops, and it started in Hamburg with my producer for the Free Speech film. As I don't know if it was a spin-off from the film or not, but he sort of started it quite soon after we finished making the film. And they do workshops all across Germany. They do Youth for Planet Luxembourg now, Youth for Planet Austria. And it teaches people, young people, how to pick up their smartphone, the basics of storytelling, how to have a sort of critical eye, how to find the right stories around you, how to take an issue that may matter to you, whether it's, you know, whether it's something in your school or whether it's something further afield, and then to develop that into a story and to use your smartphone to shoot interviews. Then eventually we'll have an editing system, so you can edit it there on your smartphone and then upload it to a database that can be shared around the world. And it's also a sort of spin-off from Fridays for Future. And if we could roll out this same education process via workshops with, you know, trainers and everything throughout the country, then, you know, we could have many sort of Greta Thunbergs on our doorstep. And that was very interesting. I mean, they've had a few very positive test cases. They've done quite a few workshops now, but one of them, there was a group of school children, and they got together as a group of five, and they did this, they made this small video on plastic in their school, and they interviewed school teachers, and they interviewed the cleaners, who actually knew the most about plastic as they're dealing with it every day, and they were able to collate evidence, and they put it to their headmaster and said, look, this is the problem in our school. Mm-hmm. You know, and the headmaster turned around and said, fine, I will now act. Thank you for doing this. You know, and then went off to make sustainable bags from all the plastic that they now sell at the school, and so on. So it has this sort of domino effect. That would be one education process. The other one would be just a full-on revolution within the education system. I mean, if we're on, you know, if we're talking about the sort of third industrial revolution, new industrial revolution, then there's a great example, you might know of it, in northern rural France, where I think it was like 8 universities and 250 high schools as like an experiment to see what would happen, would completely change their education system of how they teach. So they would move away from the teacher being the authority at the front, and, you know, instead of having like rows of kids just sitting there looking at the front, they would put each kid into a group, and you would have a group for the whole year, and that would be your kind of teaching group. So in each class they might have like 6 groups or something, and those peers are about to become your best friends, because you will teach each other essentially throughout the year. And instead of the teacher being the gatekeeper of information, they become more of a sort of mentor, and they kind of throw ideas into your group, and you're there to discuss it, to kind of learn from each other. Like, it's all about using your own initiative, and I suppose it probably looks a bit like this, to be honest. And it seems to be quite successful, so that might be another way to tackle this issue.
You had some more questions, right?
But I have not a question on this topic.
Okay.
I would have
some questions. Yeah. Is the English okay? The English is like fine. We're all
So I would like to add my question. As you just said, the younger generation gets more political nowadays. So what do you think? Should we include them nowadays more often in situations like, for example, Fridays for Future? Just like in the movie The Little Girl, did they inspire you? Or what do you think about it, that they stand up and get political nowadays in such a young age?
I mean, for me, it's absolutely fantastic. I mean, we made the film before Fridays for Future, so we didn't even see this movement coming. She was just Neve in the film was a sort of miracle, and it's a bit of a coincidence that off the back of this we've now got Fridays for Future. I mean, I think it's fantastic. I mean, it is their futures. It's our futures that we're talking about here. It's not the older generation. It's the same with, it's the same with Brexit. Massive generational divide here. Big polarization taking place within our country. And we were, as discussing with a few people at lunch, what's very interesting now is if there was a general election called tomorrow, and it's looking more and more likely right now. But if it was just 18 to 24-year-olds voting in the general election, the whole country would be red. It would be the Labour Party. It would be the sort of leftist socialists in our country. They're quite radical at the moment. And if it was 50-plus, the whole country would be blue, the Conservatives, but one seat. So that's the sort of divide, and it's a similar divide with Brexit right now, with the younger generation across the country in general wanting to remain, and the older generation in general wanting to leave the European Union. I mean, I think it's important that these young people have a voice, and that they're willing to stand up, and that there is a sort of role model to get behind. Greta, I mean, I'll encourage it in any way I can. Now young people have the tools to do it. So the great thing about Youth for Planet is we teach young people from the age of 10 to 18, 19. So it's a broad range of ages, and everyone's very responsive to it. Everyone picks it up. It doesn't really matter what age. I've got hope for groups like Fridays for Future, but it just needs to be. I think it just needs to be more democratized in a way, and I think we can do that by providing young people with more tools. And they need literacy to use those tools, but the tools need to be available. And I think having that education of how to use your smartphone as a starter is one way forward.
Natürlich. So you talk about that people have to stand up for their rights and to protest, but I think many people are afraid to stand up and say what they have for meaning. And do you think it's more because they are afraid of the situation about the law, or the situation about the social stand in the society?
Yeah, I mean, I think it depends. It depends in what context we're talking about. I mean, if you want to talk on a sort of professional level about the world of journalism nowadays, I mean, especially in my country alone, there are many journalists that have actually left the country because the surveillance is so bad. Same in America. I mean, there are many journalists in America that have left and are living in Germany, for example. Many of them live in exile in Germany, out of fear of arrest. I think we try to frame these people. We call them activists, when really they're journalists. And by calling them activists, we sort of push them out of society. We we've sort of created a position for them on the fringes of society, in that the law shouldn't really protect them. So many people, I think, in the West, increasingly with Trump, with all these right-wing movements across, you know, across Europe, at a professional level, I think are in fear of speaking out. I mean, we don't need to talk about Belarus or Russia because we know the situation there. I think on a more social level, you know, it really depends on the environment that's been given to you. Like, I think in most private conversations, you would hope that you would feel comfortable saying anything you want, and if you're upset, that you could share that with someone else. We are lucky because, unlike many other countries, like North Korea and so on, I'm sure you are restricted from becoming political at a very early age. We're very lucky to be able to sit round in a circle like this and to be able to share our views. And if you disagree, you're given the entitlement to disagree, and you're sort of given a voice to respond. So it wasn't a very good answer to your question.
But I forgot. Do you think the people, for example, in North Korea, don't talk to the people who criticize the other or the government? Don't talk to the people because they are afraid of the government then?
Well, yes. I mean, I think that's part of it. But also, you know, they've got probably some of the best propaganda in the world. I mean, they are controlling their entire population with propaganda at every level. You know, through digital propaganda, and also, you know, through the way they kind of promote their military as being like the foundation of their society. And you know, they're also advised to sort of tell on each other. So if someone is speaking out and has a certain belief, you know, they're sort of persuaded by the government to tell the government on these people. I mean, I was assisting on a film about sort of LGBT activism around the world, and it was a sort of global film, and one of the directors was German actually. And funny, he made the film, funny enough, he told me after he finished it, because he came to the premiere in Berlin and he watched the film and he said, right, I need to make my own film. So I was like, that's great, let's do it together. And so he toured around the world, going to different places. He himself was also gay, but he basically toured the countries where you could be killed and arrested and put in prison for life for being a homosexual. So it was quite an inspiring film. And he was in India, and he was interviewing. He was trying to gain access to the sort of transsexual community in India, which is, you know, being a transsexual is illegal, or was a couple of years ago. I'm not sure. Laws changed a little bit now, and they had to watch out because all the neighbours would tell on the fact they were filming, and the fact that he was transsexual. He could only be transsexual inside his house. He could only walk outside wearing sort of straight clothes, acting straight, and his only time to be free was inside his living room. But that was in fear of neighbours, you know, telling the police and everything. So we're quite far away from that community, but this sort of social repression does exist.
Very difficult.
Yeah.
I think I have one more last question. We do.
It's really short.
Yeah. Okay. Because we want to close it down. I know there's a lot of questions more. I even have Anton, but we cannot ask them all. But go ahead. And
the shortest question is: do you think about other projects in the future?
Ooh. Yeah, I mean,
it's
a
short question.
That's a question.
So it could be yes or no.
Yeah, I mean, So, yeah, I mean, yes, I am, it's nearly finished. I'm a co-producer in a film about abuse within private care homes. And we want to make it a German story as well. It's the story of an elderly care home whistleblower in the UK and her battle against probably one of the largest private healthcare companies in the UK. So that's sort of coming. And then we're starting shooting with the sort of same film team at the end of November in Chile for COP25, the UN climate, the global climate conference. And that is a film exploring the future of journalism. It's a British, German, Luxembourg, French co-production. And yeah, it's got some great producers on board, and I'm co-directing it with a German person, and it's sort of looking at the future of global journalism, not from the perspective of the New York Times. Screw that. Many filmmakers have got inside the New York Times and made that film. We want to bring you to the front lines of citizen journalism, of smartphone journalism, and we're going to do that by telling you the story of lithium, which powers everyone's smartphones, which is found in Chile.
Yeah.
So we'll see what happens.
Then we wish you good luck for your upcoming events and films that you make. We may hear more from you.
Yeah, let's do another one of these in 2 years.
Great, I'm with you. You can contact Tarkin about Twitter and Instagram. We just posted
I've certainly seen all these loads of Wolfsburg.
Really?
Instagram is like...
I couldn't check it right now.
I'm not used to it. So.
How should we end this? Somebody has a suggestion? Just by clapping our hands for the day, or just if somebody has something to say that's very smart. It's not me, so.
Jetzt hast du nur noch eine Frage. Wasn't it dangerous for you to meet Julian Assange because he could maybe hide some serious intel about the government? So
yeah,
would make a target of you.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, basically. I met him before he was in hiding down south, when he was on house arrest. And as I said in the auditorium, when I was 18, that was the first experience I had where the FBI stole the film. And then since then, it's been everything from arrested in India on terrorism charges, where I've had AK-47 live ammunition put in my bag. And a couple of years ago, my house was broken into, and the whole house was destroyed. And they took all my hard drives, left all my laptops. All my laptops were just open, and camera was taken out the bag, thrown onto the sofa. Memory card thing of the camera bag was taken, and they took.
Did you get crypto on the discs?
So on one of them there was, on the other one there wasn't. So they took all the material for this, for the free speech film, but they also took all the material for this journalism film as well. It's copied in a number of countries, which is fine. But it was still a bit like, because I was sleeping upstairs, so it wasn't very nice. But they took all the hard drives and a San Pellegrino. And it was my last fucking San Pellegrino.
Okay.
So that was really annoying.
So give it a hand and call it a day, and you have the chance to speak up to Tarkin, and he has to sign a poster for us.
Okay.
For the library here.
I didn't know I got to that stage.
Maybe you guys want to have an autograph from him. We have flyer there. You can take the flyer and have an, I don't know what's called, inner one, says that. A memory and Tarkin, he have you signed a flyer, and yes, maybe we see him back. And thanks for
having me. This has been an amazing experience.